8 May 2002. I'm in the offices of the Outreach of Hope in Colorado Springs with Dave Dervecki, and I'm Robert Kingsley. Dave, thank you again for coming in, for allowing me to come in and see you. Mm-hmm. What got you interested in baseball?
Well, I think it was really just as a young kid growing up, having some heroes watching Major League Baseball. You know, I loved Sandy Koufax and Vida Blue were two guys that I followed as a young boy. And, you know, I guess my dad loved the game, and my uncle used to play professional baseball. He was originally drafted by the Pittsburgh Pirates, which I thought was ironic because I was eventually selected in the 21st round by the Pittsburgh Pirates. And my Uncle Andy was a catcher. My dad was a catcher. And we would just go out in the backyard and play catch. And I had so much fun doing that all of a sudden, you know, you're in your neighborhood with, you know, 15 or 20 boys that live in this neighborhood, and we're all getting makeup games together and playing in the backyard. And I mean, our backyard was not a patch of grass. It was, you know, it was a dirt spot for home plate, a dirt spot for first base, second base, third base. And, you know, and then the home run was hit into the neighbor's, you know, backyard. And I guess that's where my love for the game of baseball developed. And as I began to mature and develop and continue playing, obviously that love just kept getting stronger and stronger. Eventually it got to a point where I was able to see a dream that I had when I was a little 8-year-old kid about being a Major League Baseball player come true.
Where did you grow up at?
I grew up in Boardman, Ohio, which was a suburb of Youngstown, Ohio. That particular part of the country is big-time football. Bernie Kosar was a neighbor, and just a lot of strong football out of the Steel Valley in that tri-state area, with Pennsylvania and West Virginia and Ohio. There were just a lot of great athletes came out of that area. And the DeBartlow family, who owns the 49ers, is from Boardman, from that particular area. But that was my hometown growing up. Stayed right there and went to Youngstown State University. But that's where I grew up loving baseball.
Mm-hmm. Who, other than your father and uncle, influenced you?
Well, I think there were probably several people along the journey that influenced me. I mean, I remember my high school coach, Jack Jones, in my senior year. I'll never forget, he called me into his office and he just looked at me and he said, you know, Dave, he said, I think you've got some talent to go to the next level. And he says, I don't know what that means. I don't know where you'll have an opportunity to go, but he said, I believe you've got the talent to get there. And that was a real encouragement to me. And then I went on to Youngstown State University, and Dom Roselli was my baseball coach there. And actually, Dom's main focus at YSU was the basketball team. He was a basketball coach and accumulated several records for the most wins in, you know, Division II and then beyond that. But Dom had somewhat of an influence on me during that period of time, just giving me the chance to play college baseball. I mean, I was a walk-on, and I wasn't sought by any other college in the country. After my coach, Jack Jones, said, you know, at high school, I think you've got some talent, I went on with the idea and the impression that I'd go to Youngstown State, walk on there, and hopefully that talent would, you know, begin to develop and I have a chance to play. And basically, Dom was one who gave me that opportunity. But as I was signed by the Pittsburgh Pirates and then went on into minor league baseball, Harry Dorsch was a strong influence. And I think one of the things about Harry Dorsch that really helped me, he worked with mechanics and things of that nature. He was a roving instructor for the Pittsburgh Pirates. But there were really three things. He used to bring boiled peanuts down to the bullpen, which was kind of nice. I enjoyed that. And we always talked about baseball stories. So Harry really helped to continue to nurture that love for baseball. But one of the things that he taught me to do as a pitcher was he used to always say, be a tiger out there. You know, and I guess for me, that was something that really helped me understand the importance of being intense and aggressive when I go out between those two white lines and I face the opposition. You know, go out there and be a tiger and have that focus. And then the other thing he said was get in their kitchen. And that was really the first time I had heard that term before. And little would I know how valuable that would be as a major league pitcher, because it was getting in their kitchen that allowed me to have the success I had. And I learned early on as an A-ball pitcher that in order to be successful, you had to pitch inside. And Harry Dorsch was one who helped me to understand that. I went on from A-ball to double A-ball. And it wasn't until I was traded from Pittsburgh to the San Diego Padres and went to Amarillo, Texas, and Eddie Watt was our double-A manager. Eddie, being a pitcher, obviously had an awful lot to offer. But what Eddie offered to me and what I had not experienced all the way up until that point was good, sound pitching instruction. People helped work with my mechanics. Eddie didn't mess with mechanics. He basically sat me down during games, and all of us who were starters, when we weren't on the mound, we would sit next to him, and we would have to talk baseball strategy. If the guy's on the mound pitching and you've got a 0-2 pitch coming up, what pitch are you going to throw in this situation with a man on first base? What pitch are you going to throw when you lead off an inning? If you know a hitter's a fastball hitter, what pitch do you want to throw, to start a guy off? There were just simple things that he started to get us to think about. And it was through that process that I really learned how to pitch. And Eddie also taught me a cut fastball. And that was probably the bread and butter pitch that I had throughout my career once I made it to the big leagues. And it really was, I think, of all the people from a baseball standpoint that had an influence on me, as far as taking me to a level where I could succeed at the major league level, the highest level, it was really Eddie Watt who began to nurture in me that idea that it's all about the art of pitching, not just throwing a baseball.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any teammates in the minors that had an influence on you?
I sure do. I think there were several of us on the pitching staff in 1981 in Amarillo that were a great encouragement to one another as far as our pitching was concerned. We really did pull together as a group of guys and said, we're on a mission and we're here to encourage each other, even though we're all trying to get to the big leagues. If we help each other succeed, then we'll all experience that success. And so it was really great to have that camaraderie. Guys like Andy Hawkins, Mark Thurman, Troy Dixon, I remember, was on that ball club. Tim Hamm, who I had never in my life seen a pitcher have such incredible control. This kid didn't walk anyone and had an amazing sinking fastball. Mike Barba, who was a relief pitcher. And some of these guys never got to the big leagues, but they had an incredible influence. And probably the most significant influence that I really had from any teammate whatsoever was in Amarillo, Texas, and it was Byron Ballard. He was a starter along with the other four of us. And it wasn't Byron's encouragement and his ability as a pitcher that was an influence on me. His influence came in the challenge to read the Bible and to begin to ask questions about who I am, but even more importantly, who God is and how I relate to him. And it was that influence that I believe may have had a significant impact in my life to turn my career around. At the time I was going through these questions and searching through the Bible to answer these two questions, I was 1-4. And over a period of time, I'm coming to grips with understanding that God was the one who gave me the ability to play this game, and that it was not about me going out there and pleasing and satisfying me as much as it was going out there and honoring him with my performance. All of a sudden, I began to settle into this whole idea that my most important focus on the pitcher's mound was to give the best possible effort I could give to help our ball club win, but even more importantly, to glorify God through that performance. And what it did was it settled me down, and it allowed me to go out there and just pitch my game. And as a result, I went on from there to be 14-1 through the rest of the season, and was selected as the minor league pitcher of the year for the San Diego Padres, and was flown with my wife to San Diego to watch a game, a big league game, and be introduced and given an award before the game. And that was really special. And I say that not because I believe that by becoming a Christian all of a sudden I became successful, because I don't want to send the wrong message. But what I do believe happened was God allowed me, through that process of coming into a relationship with Him through His Son, Jesus Christ, to begin to really focus on the gifts and talents that He gave me and to maximize them. And as a result, the end result was that that I did have success. So that was, there was no question in my mind that that was one of the most important years of my life in relationship to baseball as well as my spiritual journey. And those are people, too, that I have relationships with to this day. And some of them weren't pitchers. You know, there was Danny Gospel, and who played center field from UCLA, and Jerry DeSimone, who was a shortstop who now lives in Las Vegas. And I mean, there were just several guys on that team that became really good friends that, that we still communicate with today. As a matter of fact, we're desperately trying to put together some kind of a reunion of this Amarillo baseball team. And obviously Byron Ballard is one of those guys I communicate with. And so it's, that was just a very special year for us.
Where's Byron now?
Byron is living in Virginia, and Byron is doing extremely well. He went to work for UPS, and over the years in working for UPS, after he got out of the game, he and his wife made a decision to start buying stock, even when he was just, you know, packing boxes onto a truck. And he went from that to actually being a regional manager over 400 people. And then all of a sudden, UPS went public. And for several years, probably at least 10 years, Byron had been buying stock and putting it into, you know, it was part of his, I guess, retirement. And when they went public, all of a sudden, Byron became a wealthy man and retired from UPS. And he is now, he's now working with young kids in Virginia, and being a source of encouragement to them, and doing that through Young Life, which is just a really neat thing, because he just loves kids. He's the kind of guy that you're around that you just want to hang out with, because he's just got so much joy in his life and so much love for people. So he's doing extremely well.
That's really great. Is.
Yeah, it's
That's
been
great.
It's a wonderful story, in particular as it relates to a guy that never got it, saw his dream come true as a Major League Baseball player, but in other respects is now doing the very thing that I think was a part of his heart all along.
Good, good. So what year did you make it to the majors?
I made it to the big leagues in 1982. I was with the San Diego Padres. I was on the AAA ball club out of spring training. We were at the time, which was very fortunate for all of us, our AAA ball club was in Hawaii back then. So Aloha Stadium was our home field. And we spent 6 weeks on the island before I got called up to the big leagues on June 8th of 1982. 2 days prior to that, my daughter Tiffany was born, so it was a pretty special week for me. But I got called up in 1982 to begin my journey as a Major League Baseball player with the San Diego Padres.
What did that feel like the first time that you went in as a Major League ball player?
Very scary. You know, it was a great thrill for me to be able to put that uniform on. I mean, that was my dream from the time I was 8 years old back in Boardman, Ohio. And all of a sudden, to have that uniform on, it meant so much more than I had even anticipated. You know, now it was about not just the thrill of being a major leaguer, but now you've got to do things to stay there. And unfortunately, for the first 2 weeks in my career, I was throwing 55-foot fastballs, and I could not get an individual out. I mean, it was really hard on me. I had lost probably 10, 12 pounds during that time, and I was just flat out scared, and every guy that came to the plate was Babe Ruth. And so it was a real challenge for me to work through that. But I think the probably the greatest encouragement I received was from my wife, because she had challenged me to face my fears, and just to realize that you know, God had given me the talent to play, and as a result, He didn't expect me to go out there and be Nolan Ryan. He expected me to go out there and be Dave Dravecki, and that's what the Padres wanted me to be, Dave Dravecki. That's why they called me up. They liked my stuff. They didn't see a Nolan Ryan in me. They saw Dave Dravecki, this sinker ball control pitcher who had a good cut fastball that could get inside and challenge hitters. And so when I was willing to admit my fear and get it out, all of a sudden, for some reason, it was much easier to deal with. And it was the very next day after admitting my fear that I went out, and all of a sudden I almost got my first big league win, and I got people out. And I thought, you know what, I can do this. And And it was a great thrill to be able to cross over that bridge, so to speak, because I think every rookie really struggles with that, some in greater degrees than others. And you know, and for me, it was a difficult struggle, and yet I'm really grateful that my wife was able to challenge me to open up and admit that I was afraid.
Now, with the Padres, who are some of your teammates that had an influence on you?
Well, you know, I played with guys like Gary Templeton at shortstop, Tony Gwynn, some very talented people. Craig Nettles was at third base. Steve Garvey was at first. We had some pretty awesome players on our team. I think one of the things that was impressive to me as I watched, as a young kid in particular, I saw these guys at the big league level who worked very hard to stay at the big league level. It was more being led by example than by words spoken. And as I mentioned, all those guys, I mean, Tony Gwynn is a prime example. We came up together, so we were two young kids on this ball club amongst some pretty awesome players. Goose Gossage was on the team. You know, when I look at guys like Goose and Steve Garvey and Gary Templeton, Craig Nettles, I mean, these guys just went out there and they played hard every day. And it wasn't just playing hard when the umpire said play ball, but it was also the work ethic in warm-ups. You know, they would come out, and these guys are taking a lot of ground balls. You know, even Tony, through observing that, a lot of fly balls, Tony actually got with a pitching coach to work on his delivery from the outfield so that he could grab the ball with four seams and get more velocity on it, you know, to get putouts, you know, to get guys out. And so I really do believe it was the work ethic of those players around me that was the encouragement, you know, and the influence in my life. And at the same time, there was this real intense motivation within that said, you know, I don't want those young players coming up behind me to grab my spot. So if that's the case, then, you know, I've got to work just as hard as those guys. If I want to be like a Steve Garvey or a Goose Gossage or a Craig Nettles, then I've got to put my time in, and I've got, in putting my time in, I've got to put the effort in to be able to improve every day I go out there. And that was the challenge, was to not just be complacent over the fact that I was now a big leaguer, but that there was still a lot more work to be done, and that every day I could do better and I could improve on, you know, on the talents that God had given me.
Mm-hmm. Now, kind of fast forward here to 84. That had to be a special season.
1984 was an incredible year. I mean, you know, we were not considered, you know, a World Series ball club. We had some great talent, but we had old guys. You know, everybody was saying you had a bunch of old guys on that team that are on their way out. But they didn't know the makeup and character of those old guys when it came to going out and playing hard. I think we came together as a pitching staff. We had guys like Tim Lawler. Mark Thurman was on that staff. Eric Shaw was on that staff. Myself, Andy Hawkins, Goose Gossage, Craig Lefferts. I mean, we had some guys who were proven, but were older. And then we had some younger guys who weren't proven, but I think had the heart and the desire to go out there and be aggressive and realize that if we pulled together as a team, and for us in particular, especially in 84, because I was a swing man. I really wasn't an established starter or reliever. I was being asked to do everything, and I liked that. Now, my arm didn't like it very well, but I liked it. And I'll never forget, as we were moving towards the end of the season and then into the playoffs and the World Series, Goose and Andy Hawkins and myself and Craig Lefferts, there were several of us, and I can't remember the fifth guy in the bullpen at the time, but we basically decided we were going to be a bullpen by committee. And we were going to do this thing as a unit. We were going to realize that we need to basically sacrifice ourselves every day for the ball club so that if we were called to go in long relief, it didn't make any difference which one of us was asked to do that. You go out there and you do it and get the job done. If it's, you know, to come in for a hold, which would basically be to set up your, you know, closer, then by golly, that's your role and that's your responsibility. You go out there and you suck it up and you bow your neck and you get the guys out. So you could set Goose Gossage to close. And 1984 was just a, it was in some respects, it was like a fantasy, a fairy tale. And what a great year it was for us to be able to accomplish what we did, because Ray Kroc had just died prior to the season starting. And we dedicated the season to he and his family. And you know, there are people who have pros and cons about ownership. But Ballard Smith, who was the president of the ball club at that time, Joan Kroc, the owner, and Jack McKeon, who was the general manager, those people, they helped to create a family atmosphere. And I love those folks. I mean, they were wonderful to us. You know, and I think because of that family ownership, it made it that much more special to do something in honor and in memory of a guy who really was responsible for keeping San Diego baseball alive. And so that year was just a fairy tale year for us that we all were extremely grateful for. And I think one of the guys that I was probably most grateful for on that ball club was Terry Kennedy. He was behind the dish, and he got a bad rap as a catcher from some people. Others, you know, gave him, you know, thumbs up. But in my opinion, he was one of the best hitting catchers in the league. And for me personally, there was no better catcher behind the dish than Terry Kennedy. I love big targets. And Terry Kennedy was a thinking catcher. And he understood me as well as anybody else. And I think he played a key role in the success of our ball club because, you know, you're really in charge of things with everything in front of you. And it was very important for him to understand his pitching staff and to bring about that success by knowing his pitching staff well enough for us to go out there and be as successful as we were. So 84 was a great year. It was wonderful and a year I'll never forget. And it really didn't matter whether or not we got beat by the Detroit Tigers, because nobody expected us to be in the World Series, period. Yeah. So that was pretty special.
In the playoffs, you went down 2-0 to the Cubs.
Yeah.
And what was the attitude of the club then?
It was very interesting. I'll never forget this. We were on a plane flying home from Chicago. And on the plane, there were several of us who were sitting there talking. And we were just kind of wondering what was going to unfold. And all of a sudden, Goose was in the back with us, and we were standing there, and he looked at every one of us, and he said, "Guys, I don't really care if we're down 2-0. He said, "One of the things we've got to think of now is that we play one baseball game at a time. This is a one-game series, and we're going back to our home field, which is where we will have an advantage, but we take this. We don't look at what will happen possibly in game you know, 4 or game 5. It's all about game 3. And it's a one game series. And what Goose did was he brought our focus into one game instead of worrying about whether or not we were going to lose. It was a focus of winning one game. And it was really interesting because all of a sudden it changed our focus and it energized us. Well, we didn't know what was happening when we got back to San Diego and back to the ballpark where, you know, we were going to get in our cars and go home. But we get back there and there's several thousand people waiting for us to cheer us on. And that was like putting icing on the cake after hearing Goose Gossage talk. Because you listen to a guy who's been there. You have respect for someone who knows what it takes to win when you're in those kind of situations. He experienced it in New York. If there was anyone that had something to offer, it was Goose. And it was he that really turned us around. I'm convinced that it was that statement on that plane that really helped this ball club to get its focus back so that we could come back and win. And then when you've got guys who, like Garvey, are just clutch, you know, in the fourth game to take it to the fifth, he hits that home run off of Lee Smith. And then we go into the fifth game, and, you know, we're up against Rick Sutcliffe, who was just a stud that year. And, you know, we just stayed at it. You know, and you always hear that phrase, the game's not over until the fat lady sings. Well, bottom line was these boys in our ball club, these guys, the veterans, did not let us quit until the last out. Just stay with it. Just stay with it. And, you know, being down 3-1 against Sutcliffe, you're thinking, you know, how in the world are we going to overcome this? And then all of a sudden, the floodgates open with one error at first base. And you know, that was, and when I say it really didn't matter whether we won or lost in the World Series, I say that in the context of realizing we had just let all the air out of our bubble in that series against the Cubs. I mean, it was unbelievable, you know, because in the ninth inning of Game 5 that afternoon, the trainer had to run up and down the bench with smelling salts in a bag because guys were hyperventilating. I mean, that's how intense it got, and that's how, I mean, that's where the energy was and the excitement and the just this, you know, the nerves. You know, now we're going out in the ninth inning and we've got to get these guys out, and we go to the World Series. And it was a pretty intense time, but it was so awesome. It was one of the most joyous experiences that I've ever had as a baseball player. That was pretty cool.
Right. And that Detroit Tiger team was a great team.
Oh, they were awesome. They were the best team in baseball that year, and I think one of the best teams to go down in history. No question. You know, when you go up against guys like Parrish behind the plate, Chet Lemon in center field, Whitaker and Hammer, Lou Whitaker and Alan Trammell at short and second, probably the strongest defense up the middle of any team in the game. And then to have, you know, all these surrounding cast and Petrie and Morris on the mound and several others, Hernandez in the bullpen. I mean, we went up against the best team in baseball, and the best team in baseball beat us. And, you know, when you're playing baseball and you start spring training, everybody's goal is to be one of the last two teams standing. And in 1984, we experienced that, and that was a thrill.
How was Dick Williams as a manager?
I personally liked Dick Williams as a manager. He was tough. You know, he shot straight with you. If he didn't like what you were doing, he let you know. But Dick Williams motivated in a very different way. His motivation came by getting on players. And I think from a psychological standpoint, for me, the tougher you were on me, the greater the challenge it was for me to go out and excel. And so I had no problem with that at all. And what I came to love and appreciate about Dick Williams was that, you know, he knew he had a job to do on the field, and it was to get the best and the most he could out of every player, every game. But what I really liked about Dick Williams was when he took his uniform off and he was no longer on that field as the general manager, you know, as the field manager, because then he became a nice guy. My wife and I had the pleasure of getting to know he and his wife, and they're wonderful people, and it was a real privilege to be able to play for him.
Right. Now, you went after the Padres to the Giants. Who were you traded for?
That was the big deal for the third baseman for the Giants at the time, Chris. Oh man, I can't remember his last name. That was the key trade. He was supposed to be this superstar third baseman. It just didn't pan out for him. And Mark Davis was in the trade. Mm-hmm. Mark Grant was in the trade. Another left-handed pitcher and this third baseman. And Kevin Mitchell, myself, and Craig Lefferts went over to the Giants. And you know, we were very disappointed when this trade took place. You know, we were really liking San Diego. You know, I had no clue outside of, you know, the Westin Hotel in Union Square in San Francisco, going there to play the Giants, and how beautiful that was. But I had no clue what it was going to be like living in San Francisco. All of a sudden, I've got to uproot my family, and I've got to move them to San Francisco. And so it was very hard. But what was really cool was when we were traded from San Diego on the 4th of July to the Giants, the very next day, we were in Chicago. So we had to fly to Chicago. Giants were there. We met up with them there. And when we got there, we got our uniforms on. We didn't even have uniforms with our names on them yet. And so we got there, and we got dressed up for the game. And all of a sudden, Roger Craig, Norm Sherry, and Al Rosen invited us into Roger's office in the clubhouse in Chicago. And we walked in, and, you know, we're just thinking, you know, where do we go from here? I mean, we're with a ball club for X number of years. You feel you're getting established. You want to end your career there. Now you're with a new club, and you've got the manager and the pitching coach and the general manager, Al Rosen, sitting in front of you, and you're wondering what they're going to say. And they looked at us and they said, guys, we believe you're the key to us winning the division. This is the trade that we feel will take us over the hump.
And this is what year?
This is 1987.
87.
And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, man, this is awesome. I'm being embraced by a ball club, and they think so much of this trade that they feel we're going to take them over the hump and get into the playoffs. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. I mean, that was an incredible year for the San Francisco Giants, and the reality was that when you look back on that year statistically and player for player, we were probably the better ball club in the NLCS going up against St. Louis to get to the World Series. And we really had them on the ropes. But what was unfortunate was a couple guys on the ball club started popping off during the playoff, during that series, as to how good we were. And we woke up a sleeping giant. And these guys came out and just put it to us. And that was real unfortunate.
Was that the series with the one flap down?
Yes, it was. Jeffrey Leonard.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, one flap down. And he had a great series. He was the MVP of the series, and we lost.
Yeah.
You know, it was pretty incredible. But that was I pitched the two best games of my career in that series. Beat John Tudor in game 2, 5-0, and threw a two-hit shutout. And then in game 6, lost to John Tudor, 1-0. And, you know, in that series, I only gave up one run in 15 innings. And so that was just a huge series for me. And it opened the door for me to be the opening day pitcher in 1988 against the Dodgers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was an unbelievable comeback by the Cards, too.
Oh, it sure was. And what a great place to play baseball. I mean, what a great organization. And
now, what year did you become ill in?
It was 1988 when I was diagnosed. After opening day, beating the Dodgers 5-1, I was really thinking that, you know, 1988 was going to be my year. And by September of 1988, they were diagnosing me with cancer in my left arm. Mm-hmm. Halfway between the shoulder and the elbow.
What kind of symptoms did you have?
I had no symptoms. There was just a lump.
Okay.
And it was a hard mass, no pain. I was actually able to pitch with it.
Yeah.
It didn't bother me in the least bit. And I started having shoulder problems totally unrelated to the lump,
mm-hmm.
which then shut me down for the 1988 season. I had to go in for arthroscopic surgery, and they repaired a partially torn bicep tendon. But then I tried to rehab, and by September I wasn't able to do that, and the lump had grown to half the size of a golf ball. Doctors became very concerned and went in and did some tests, and that's when I was diagnosed with the cancer, a desmoid tumor, and from there they had to go in on October 7th, which was my 10th wedding anniversary, to remove the mass along with 50% of my deltoid muscle. And that's when the doctors said, outside of a miracle, you'll never pitch again.
Right. And what were your teammates' reactions to this, and who stood by you during this time from your ball club?
Yeah, I think that the support overall was just incredible. I mean, the guys were right there with me. Probably the closer friends that I had on the team, guys like Atlee Hammaker, Scott Gereltz, Brett Butler, players like that, who I was pretty close with, they really were there for me. And yet the entire team and the entire organization were very supportive of what I was going through. You know, I got tons of calls from people as I was going through the rehabilitation and all that. And there were a lot of professional athletes calling to support and encourage me. And that was real encouraging. But my teammates were, and the organization were, very supportive.
Mm-hmm. Now, describe the miracle that did take place to get you mm-hmm. back.
Well, you know, when I define the miracle, I don't define it in the context of all of a sudden, you know, I'm told I'm outside of a miracle, I'll never be able to pitch, and then poof, I'm there and I'm on the mound and I'm pitching 10 months later without any hard work, without any therapy, without any, without doctors being involved, without nurses playing a part. I believe a miracle really can be defined in recognizing how God used people in my life, starting with the doctors who diagnosed me, to the doctors who did the surgery, to the doctors and nurses who followed up with the rehabilitation, to the trainers and the physical therapists who then took control and brought strength back into my arm and set me up for the opportunity to actually be able to pitch. And then on August 10th, 1989, to actually see this become a reality was just overwhelming. Because, you know, again, the doctors did not know how anyone could come back and pitch without a deltoid muscle, being such a major muscle in relationship to, you know, being able to throw a baseball.
Right.
So that was critical. And as a result, it was real special to stand on that mound once again. And what raced through my mind and my heart was just being thankful to God that I had been given another chance. Because I loved the game so much. And I remembered as a young boy dreaming to be a Major League Baseball player. And I saw that dream become a reality. And then cancer all of a sudden comes in and takes it away. And my dream was once again to beat the odds and to go against what everybody was saying and to see that dream become a reality for the second time. And I was given that opportunity, and for that I was extremely grateful. 5 days later, I'm in Montreal in the sixth inning, and I'm feeling great. I'm throwing as well as I've ever thrown. As a matter of fact, with the comeback game and that first five innings against the Expos, I thought, you know what? I'm doing so well, and I am in such a groove that I think I finally hit that place where I could establish myself as a 15 to 20 game winner for a couple of years. I'm in the sixth inning, and all of a sudden I rear back and throw a fastball to Tim Raines, and my left arm snaps in half, and my career's over. And obviously that was a very painful experience for me, both physically and emotionally. But I realized at that point in time that, first of all, I was not supposed to do it. You know, the doctor said, outside of a miracle, you'll never pitch. And so when I look at this, I don't see this as a tragedy. You know, I'm now looking at this as I was given an opportunity to come back and play again. And, you know, there was one thing that was really cool. I mean, I was 2-0. I mean, I ended up undefeated in my final year of my career. Not too many guys can say that. They certainly wouldn't want to walk away from the game the way I did. But at the same time, I also came face to face with realizing that there was something bigger than baseball that was taking place in my life. And baseball was a platform that would launch me to that next place. And it was something that not only was bigger than baseball, but that became much more important than baseball could ever be. And yet I certainly wouldn't deny the importance of baseball in my life, because without it, I wouldn't have the platform I have today. I wouldn't be traveling around the country and sharing this story and speaking to people and encouraging them through my personal journey of pain and suffering as they experience their own. We wouldn't have this ministry called the Outreach of Hope that reaches out and encourages cancer patients, amputees, and others who suffer with books that we've had the opportunity to write. I would have never written a book had this not happened. We would have never talked in these books about pain and suffering to encourage people. And now seeing the results of that experience as it relates to helping literally thousands of people through our resources come face to face with the fact that God really does care for them on the journey of pain and suffering has been a real privilege. And so looking back, man, I wouldn't trade it in for anything. You know, I mean, it'd be great to have my arm, maybe one more day to be able to throw one more backdoor slider. But when I look at the big picture, it's, you know, I wouldn't change a thing.
Now, obviously you've encouraged thousands of people after the event that unfolded happened. During the time of the first onset of cancer, and your rehabilitation, and right after you came back, what was your feelings with the nation? Just unbelievable happy that here's Dave Gravecki back. I remember reading it, and I was just overjoyed.
Oh, it was overwhelming. I mean, you know, I go home to my apartment, and my garage is full of mail. I can't park my car in the garage. I mean, the entire garage is full of mail. The entire garage is full of gifts. People sending me books. People sending me pictures, and these statements of encouragement that are framed, and then people sending, you know, just all kinds of stuff, just wishing us well, along with cards and their prayers and thoughts, and I mean, it was just overwhelming. We thought, my gosh, I mean, here I am from Youngstown, Ohio. I mean, who am I? I mean, you expect this for a Johnny Bench or a Pete Rose or a Willie Mays or, you know, somebody like that. And here's Dave Dravecky getting all this attention from around the country and around the world. And, you know, and it was just, it was so, it was such a humbling experience for my wife and I to see that kind of outpouring of love and care and concern for us. And what it helped us to recognize, even more importantly, was how much God really loved and cared for us. Because that's how we believe and understand that the way in which God can show his faithfulness to us is obviously through reading the scriptures and being encouraged that way by reading the Bible. But I think for many of us, in order for us to be able to put a face with God, it's real important for us to see that encouragement come through those faces. And God uses people to be a vehicle through which he can use to show how much he loves and cares for us. And that's what we experienced firsthand. And that was powerful. That was just incredibly overwhelming to Jan and I. You know, and it's something that we'll never forget, and a lesson that we've learned in the value of encouraging people who do hurt. And that's probably why, no, it's not probably, it is why we do what we do today.
Well, great, great. Again, I thank you for your time. I know you have a busy schedule.
No, it's my pleasure, Rob.
It's been a wonderful, wonderful experience. I wish you all the best.
Thank you. I appreciate that.